Welcome back to This Green Earth, the weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us on the phone is Professor Rob Davies. He's Associate Professor of Professional Practice at Utah State University's Department of Physics. And he's here to talk about, well, ostensibly, a talk he's going to be giving on and about the climate this coming Monday at the Park City Hospital. And so, Dr. Davies, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Chris.
Okay, so we'll get to some of the particulars about the talk you're giving. You know, I don't know if you had a chance to listen to Nell and I kind of covering a couple of news items with respect to energy consumption here in the U.S. in 2018, this past year. Carbon dioxide emissions rose by 3.4% during 2018, and that's the first time there's been a rise in carbon dioxide emissions in the past 8 years. A lot of that is...
The first time in the U.S.
First time in the U.S., yes, in the past 8 years. And, you know, there's... The citations are a strong economy, growing economy, increased emissions related to transportation, increased emissions related to electricity generation, of course, and other heavy industry elements all resulted in increased emissions. But that's only the I guess that that's the downside. The upside is that that's the first time in the 8 years that we've had an uptick. So we're seeing pluses and minuses in our efforts to reduce our carbon emissions. So how do you see that? What are you seeing over the last few years that either give you, you know, hope or concern?
Well, so it's a great question, and it's sort of encapsulated in this question is just the whole suite of complexity in moving forward and trying to figure out what in fact constitutes a meaningful action in trying to reduce our emissions. So with respect to, let's just put this in context, global emissions had been flat for a few years up until 2017, but then started to climb again in 2017, up 1.5%, and then in 2018, up 2.5% here in the United States. As you just mentioned, just this year, we're up 3.5%. And so the question is, of course, as we try to figure out, you know, where the emissions come from in the economy is pretty complex, and there are lots of ways to do the accounting. The short answer for the global flattening was viewed as lots of countries switching to natural gas over coal, which does have lower carbon dioxide emissions. And then, of course, there was the 2008 financial meltdown that kind of slowed down industry across the globe and certainly here in the U.S., and that was a factor here in emissions reductions in the U.S. More recently, the U.S. has been also transitioning from coal to natural gas, which has lower carbon dioxide emissions.
Right.
But just to throw a little bit of bad news, you know, just sort of, what am I trying to say, poison the pie, unfortunately.
Right.
In that accounting of reduced emissions in the U.S. over the last several years prior to this year, of course, was not included things like methane emissions from natural gas extraction. So while it's true, for example, that burning natural gas creates less carbon dioxide than burning coal, about half as much, and there are other benefits as well, which, you know, a lot fewer particulate pollutants.
Right, we mentioned that,
heavy metals, that sort of thing. But if we're just talking about climate change, if we're just talking about carbon emissions, methane, which is what natural gas is a much more powerful greenhouse gas. So if you don't burn the methane, but the methane leaks, that is a real problem for carbon emissions because it's a much more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And the numbers are if you leak more than a percent or two of the methane that you're extracting, so it leaks instead of burning it, then it's actually worse than burning coal or greenhouse gas emissions. And here in the United States, lots of data in various extraction basins show that the rates of leaking are well exceed the 1 or 2%. In the Uinta Basin, measurements of as high as 11%. So,
wow.
I think we need to. So that's just a little bit of background to say, right. You know, we need to take the numbers with even the reduction numbers with a little bit of a grain of salt. Now, the larger picture, of course, is that we exist in an economy that is still principally fueled by fossil fuels. And what the goal has been is to, up until this point, is to what's called decouple economic growth from carbon emissions,
right.
So that you can grow your economy without growing your carbon emissions. It's been thought that that has been happening. But when you start to do the, over the past few years, but when you start to do the sort of the full emission accounting, when you say, well, let's not just look at the emissions in the United States that were generated in the United States, but also the emissions, let's say, that were generated in China in order to produce for the United States. So in other words, we haven't changed the emissions, we've just exported them
right.
to another place. When you start to do those kinds of accountings, along with the methane, then you find out that emissions actually have not really been decoupled from the growth.
Hmm.
And what we're seeing now is you've kind of gotten all the benefit you can from just burning natural gas instead of coal, and a growing economy that is not decoupled from emissions necessarily starts to grow its emissions again. And as you mentioned, that's what we're seeing, the emissions in the trucking industry, in manufacturing, and in the airline, all a sign of a growing economy that's not decoupled from carbon emissions, and so the emissions go up.
All right, well then, I stand corrected, because before you came on, we were talking. I suggested that there was a decoupling between these carbon emissions, as per this article, per this study by the Rhodium Group, and economic growth. But you're saying when you add in the economy that we take advantage of, or is actually linked, that we are linked to in, say, China and other countries, that decoupling goes away.
In fact, the best, yes, there are studies that suggest that. And I should also, there's more nuance here. I should say that there's no question that we have gotten more efficient at producing economic growth per unit of emission. And so that's what would be called a relative decoupling.
Okay.
The challenge is that how big is that relative decoupling? And the study you mentioned is in conflict with a number of others, particularly a couple that were done on the UK economy, that where you change your accounting and you start to account for the things that are manufactured offshore, start to account for the shipping involved that doesn't come into anybody's accounting, and then you start to account for things like methane emissions, and the decoupling is much, much weaker than you might have originally thought. And I'm not saying that the study that you're quoting is misleading. It's just that this is actually a difficult kind of accounting to do, and it's not quite clear. The physics of this, and this is kind of an ongoing large discussion, I would say, debate between the world of physics and the world of economics, is that you can, even if you are able to decouple relatively, so you get more efficient at extracting economic activity from burning fossil fuels, there is a limit to that decoupling. In other words, you can't. It's very difficult to absolutely decouple your emissions from your economic growth.
Right.
And so that once you get the low hanging fruit, which is kind of what we've done, then the question gets harder, and you have to start looking at, well, how are we actually running the economy? If the goal is to reduce the emissions, and that's all the climate cares about, is how many molecules you throw up in the atmosphere. It doesn't care how efficiently you do it. It just cares how many you throw up there. Then we have to actually look at restructuring the way that we run our economy.
So what is next? Yeah, how do we make those steps towards, more relative decoupling, or this more complete actual decoupling of the economy and the
It sounds like higher
carbon.
Fruit.
Yeah,
the low fruit.
The higher fruit.
What's the higher fruit?
Yeah.
Well, let's see. So the to bring in, so we, I'm so glad you were gone down this direction in the conversation because it starts to bring in the notion of what is actual meaningful response versus response that seems meaningful but turns out not to be.
Right. Yeah.
And that's of course what we need. We need to be actually reducing emissions. So the first part of this discussion is to recognize that emissions come from far more than simply energy generation and so electricity generation and transportation. Emissions, for example, from manufacturing processes like cement production account for up to 8% of the global emissions. And that's not because you're using fossil fuels to heat up the minerals to create the cement. That's part of it. But it's because when you heat up the minerals, those minerals emit carbon dioxide.
Right.
it's part of cooking the cement.
Right.
So that's one example. Another example is agriculture. A lot of our carbon emissions, what we call carbon emissions, because everything is sort of, whether it's methane or carbon dioxide, it gets or other greenhouse gases, it gets converted into what's called a carbon dioxide equivalent. And in fact, one confusing piece of this is that one very important greenhouse gas in our in the Earth system is nitrous oxide.
Right.
So there's no carbon there, but it's part of a carbon emission. And that's because it's a very powerful greenhouse gas, and then you just convert it to, well, this much nitrous oxide would be the same as X amount of carbon dioxide.
Mm-hmm.
So nitrous oxide emissions, for example, and ammonia emissions and a lot of carbon dioxide emissions come from agricultural practices. Actually just releasing the carbon and the nitrous oxide from the soil. So as a result of that, we start to see that, okay, there are pieces of our large pieces of the carbon equation, deforestation is another one, that are not tied to energy generation. And so when we talk about getting more efficient in our economy at producing growth, we're generally looking, those efficiencies are coming from our efficiencies in energy use. But they're not at all, for example, addressing the agricultural emissions, which are up to a third of our total carbon emissions.
Wow.
Somewhere between a fifth and a third. Again, that's a difficult carbon accounting equation. So what all of this tells us is that we've done a good job so far on the energy sector. We're starting, we have been able to somewhat decouple growth in there, but as you approach the limits of your efficiency gains in energy generation, you've still got these huge sections of emissions where you've not been getting more efficient. So, for example, agricultural emissions. And then, you know, that limits how much you can decouple your whole economy from the greenhouse emissions. I'm hoping that made some sort of sense.
Well,
absolutely.
I want to make sure that I understand when we talk about agricultural industry and agricultural-related emissions, are we also including things like the meat and dairy industry, which are huge contributors to carbon equivalents?
And certainly this is no secret, but the numbers are, I just gave you that agricultural emissions are between a fifth and a third of our total emissions.
Yeah.
Of that, so if we now just focus on the agricultural emissions, about 80% is from industrial animal agriculture.
Wow.
And so by far, the biggest thing, the biggest piece of that agricultural puzzle is animal emissions from industrial animal agriculture. Absolutely.
Right. So, the things we do as individuals to reduce our consumption of meat and dairy, like I call it big meat or big cow, big cattle, big cow,
right.
All helps. In some ways, you know, every little bit matters, or every meter matters, as I used to describe it.
That's absolutely true. And here's a good time for us to maybe even further nuance the question. And that is that we're dealing on several different time scales here. So with respect to climate change, and sort of if our goal is to avert dangerous disruption of the climate system, leading to even catastrophic disruption of the climate system. And I'm using that word somewhat technically, catastrophic meaning unadaptable.
Mm, okay.
And with the further caveat that there are already people on the planet who have experienced serious, even catastrophic impacts from the climate change that we have already had. So with those caveats, but they're more localized, right? But if we want to prevent those very serious impacts from even dangerous impacts from occurring on a global scale, then this is this number of 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees of total global average warming, trying to avert that much, of which we've already warmed up 1 degree. So if we call that our line, the timescales are, we don't have, on our current trajectory, and that includes the efficiency gains, we're going to burn through our carbon budget for a 1.5 degree temperature rise in the next decade.
Wow. Okay.
So what that tells us is that we really need to get our emissions down very quickly right up front. And so you can imagine that the strategy a society would have is to say, well, we've sort of got an emergency right in front of us. And we need to navigate the emergency, but then once the emergency is navigated, we need to continue to, you know, in this case, develop an economy and an existence, societal systems that where the carbon emissions eventually go to zero. But right up front, we've got to get them down very quickly to give ourselves more time to do that. And so so it's certainly possible that we come up with a global air travel system that has much, much lower carbon emissions.
Right.
Even electrifying the transportation. And there are, in fact, airlines that are trying to do this right now in Scandinavia, where the electricity is coming for low carbon solutions, energy sources. So, but that takes time, right? And in the meantime, we've got to get those emissions down so that we don't sort of irreversibly disrupt the climate system, and dangerously so. And so that involves sort of the belt tightening that you could imagine happened in something like a wartime situation. And often World War II is thrown up as a nice analog to this, and to say, well, look, for the next X number of years, we just need to buckle down. We need to have victory gardens. We need to buy war bonds. We're going to ration things like rubber and metal and all of the things that happened during wartime, United States. We're going to stop producing automobiles. I don't know if most people know that we stopped producing. It was illegal to produce and sell new automobiles during World War II in the United States. The manufacturing capability was redirected towards the wartime effort.
Right.
Wow.
Now, of course, nobody said, look, we're going to do this forever. But the idea was, while we've got the emergency, we need to take emergency measures. And then once we navigate the immediate thing, then we can relax those. And I think a lot of strategies for reducing our carbon emissions follow that same model, which is right now we've got to get our emissions down quickly.
Right.
So that does mean moving to a footing of trying very hard to reduce personal consumptions, local consumptions, say in Park City, which Park City, I think, is working very hard to do, and state, you know, on all scales, from local all the way up to national and global. And then doing that gives yourself time to redevelop the systems, the agricultural system, the economic system, the energy system, the transportation system, so that they operate on a very low carbon emission scenario.
Well, Rob, with that in mind, you have a talk coming up here in town on Monday the 14th at the Park City Hospital. And do you just want to give us, you know, a 30-second overview of kind of like what you'll be covering in that and what people might learn?
Certainly. So the idea, of course, is I think we're past the discussion now in our society as to whether or not this is happening and why. The tagline that's often used is climate change is real, it's us, it's bad, and we're sure. And now the discussion really is, what do we do?
Mm-hmm.
And during the talk, what I want to do is look at, in a more detailed fashion, what does it look like to reduce our emissions in a manner consistent with which the physics tells us we need to avoid these more dangerous impacts of climate change. and start to get into the nuance that we've just been discussing, which takes us a little bit, substantially further than just decarbonizing the electricity production.
All right. So all of that you'll talk about?
I will.
And it'll be a great talk. And again, it's at Park City Hospital next Monday, the 14th, at the Blair Education Center at the hospital. It starts at 6:30, and I'm sure there'll be time after your talk for questions, lots of questions or so. Dr. Rob Davies, he is the Associate Professor of Professional Practice at Utah State University's Department of Physics. As always, Rob, thanks so much for joining us, and we will see you Monday.